Welcome to the Dirt on the Past,
the Museum Edition,
a YouTube and podcast program of the Extreme History Project, which explores ancient and historical topics relating to artifact collections from the Museum of the Rockies right here in Bozeman, Montana.
At Extreme History, we explore the good, the bad, and the ugly about our human past because, let's face it, history isn't pretty, but it's so important to know because it's at the very thing that has led us to the most critical concerns in the present.
So join me, Nancy Mahoney,
and me, Crystal Alegria,
as we talk to archaeologists and historians who have been digging in the dirt
and in the archives
and in museum collections to uncover fascinating histories that are relevant to today's issues
and can help us move forward with a deeper understanding of the past.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we're the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. And this week, as usual, we are at the EO Wiegand Digital Learning Lab in the Museum of the Rockies. And we're so excited today to bring you a show with a curator of history here, Michael Fox. And we are going to be talking about historic photos with him today. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here.
We're glad you're here. You are here, Michael, and we're so excited to be talking about historic photographs today. I work with historic photographs all the time, as do you, I'm sure, Michael. And so we're going to just do a deep dive into these photos and see what we can see in them. So
yeah,
excited.
Yeah, a nice collection that the museum has here. So, you know, historic photos, as Crystal said, an important part of the work a historian does. Archaeologists can use them too. A great way to learn more about the past, look at how things looked at different moments in time. They're really a primary source of information for how people lived, showing us how even sometimes they dressed, how they interacted with each other. And it's just this very visceral representation that you know, we recognize, you know, we have so much of our lives are photographed today. So historic photos can answer a lot of questions we have. And sometimes they can provide fodder for new questions. We like to know when the photo was taken. We like to know who took the photo, maybe even what sort of camera they used to take it. Were they paid to take it? What was going on with all of that background for the photo? And those, especially if we have collections from a particular person, a photographer who maybe was prolific in what they photographed, either professionally or as an amateur. So today we're going to look more closely at the historic photos in the Museum of the Rockies collection. And Michael, we'll start by asking you if you can give us just a little short history on how photographs came to be part of Museum of the Rockies collection and what are some of examples of the collections that you have here?
Sure. Our collection really started with the founding of the museum in 1957, and it was founded by Dr. Carolyn McGill. And McGill herself was a great collector of historic photos. She was a medical doctor in Butte, came to Butte in about 1916, 1915. And immediately took on the role of historian, started collecting objects, collecting costume, collecting photos about the history of Montana. And in 1956, she was awarded a honorary doctorate from Montana State College, which is now Montana State University, in history. And as you know, part of that kind of ceremony, the president of the university offered her the use of three Quonset heads on campus to house her collection. So our photo collection started Gill's collecting back in 1957. And over time, we've just built on top of that, built more and more. Almost 100% of the collection is from donations.
Okay.
And when you you know, are dealing with historic photographs, as you were saying, Nancy, a lot of what you're looking for is who's the photographer, where was the photographer made, what's the subject, you know, when was it made, that kind of stuff. With photo collections, oftentimes we don't have those that information. We don't have all of those pieces. So, again, as historians, we might be looking at the piece itself to say, oh, well, this person is dressed this way. this might tell us something about.
Okay. So you kind of have to reverse engineer, figure out the time frame, the location, exactly. Who it might be. Okay.
And sometimes we have clues, no idea. Security. I mean, to get to just a dead end. We don't
yeah.
know.
Okay.
So we have a huge collection here. It's, I'm guessing, around 90,000 individual.
Oh, my goodness.
That's so many.
So it's big. So
I don't know how you can even catalog all of that. That's
it's an ongoing
massive.
Process.
Yeah.
And we have a selection of those on our website, which is, you know, museumoftherockies.org. And then you go to departments and you go to cultural history. And on that page, there's a link to our photo archive. And it is set up by date, it's set up by photographer, it's set up by subject matter,
okay.
and by particular collections that we have. So we have a big collection by Feminine Schlechten, two generations of portrait photographers
and
commercial photographers here at Bozeman. So it's pretty extensive. And all of the images that we'll see today are online.
Okay.
So anybody can.
Yeah. Okay. And so that photo, that online photo collection is super nice because you can search by all those different categories
right.
that you said, and you can see the different photographs. And then if someone wants to order one of those photographs, they can just go ahead and order it from that website. So it's really nice. It's in, and you can, even if you don't want to order them, I suggest people just go on and browse around because the photos are so amazing and they give a real overview of historic life in the West.
Absolutely. Sure. And because they come from such a large variety of sources, there are always surprises.
Yeah.
There are things that, you know, you might have one photographer taking a bunch of photos of one thing, and then there'll be one thing of something else completely different. And I'll show you an example.
Okay. Fantastic.
First of all, I want to look at cameras, and we've got a large collection of cameras. So first, I got a quiz for you.
Okay.
Two, what are called view cameras.
Yes.
To see what the photo is going to be, you have to look at the back of the camera. Generally, there's a piece of ground glass at the back. So you use that to focus.
Okay.
And to frame whatever you're taking the photo of. So these are two pretty similar looking cameras.
Uh-huh.
This one doesn't have the lens, but I brought it out for a particular reason.
Okay.
So I was just asking you, which one do you think is older?
Oh, what do you think, Nancy?
I feel like the one that my husband has looks more like that one. So I'm going to say this one's older.
Okay. And I'm going to say that one just to be opposite, just for the heck of it.
Okay, good.
Well,
are we both right? Do we get a prize? Okay.
This one looks older because of the condition of it. It's in really bad condition. It's really old and beat up. But that one is actually considerably older.
Considerably older.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think this was probably made between 1868 and 1870.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is old.
And in fact, it's so old that the camera itself is not marked. Like in the barrier.
Really?
They didn't even bother to put their names on it.
Wow.
It's all handmade.
It is beautiful.
Probably made in London. And the way we are inferring that is the lens is by a guy named Dahlmeyer out of London. And this particular lens was only made between 1863 and 1865.
Oh my goodness, that's
nice.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
so,
that's
and
nice
this would have been mounted on a tripod.
You
right?
would have
if
put this on a tripod.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And I want to bring out these two types because this is a what we call a wet plate camera. This is a dry plate camera.
Ooh, the wet plate ones.
So what is the age of this one?
This is about from 1938.
Okay, well,
so
that's way
much,
older. You were really
much,
right.
Yeah, so that's much, much older. Yeah,
well, so. I know Ian likes to use he's brought out his camera like that, put on a tripod, and you have the whole blanket that goes over you. And it is a magnet for people when we've been in South Africa, when he's been in Yellowstone Park, whenever he brings it out, people are drawn to it. And he's often looking for models and trying to do, because it's great for portraiture and things. And it is this big deal to use it. I'm sure it's still easier than the sweat plate one, but it produces phenomenal quality images that you can blow up really big. There's so many pixels in there, or whatever you would have called them then. So yeah. So go ahead, Michael. I'm super excited.
What you're talking about are really large format photography, and that's exactly what these are. This isn't like your little 35 millimeter image. these are big images that are extremely clear, exactly as you're saying. And I've got a couple of examples of what those look like. So the one your husband is probably producing is probably a larger version of this.
Yes, these negatives. Wow.
Oops. Your paper over.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's not. It's not. It's not clear. It's on double sided. Oh. So.
It looks a lot like this.
Yeah. There we go.
See that?
Oh wow!
That is a harvester right there.
Yeah.
So this image is from about 1903, but it's made on celluloid film. Which means it's not like the scary nitrate film, which can spontaneously combust.
Oh, good.
But from, I would say, from the early 1890s onward, this was really kind of the standard that you would use in your large format camera.
Right.
Wow. Now, previous to this, they were using glass plates.
Okay. So this is like a negative film, like we.
It's exactly a negative film.
And it's just one is in there at a time.
Yep.
And then you have to change it each
time.
You pull
the magazine out. It looks like this. It's a double-sided magazine, so you have one sheet of film, or in this case, one sheet of glass on each side.
Isn't that beautiful? And so you can get two in there, but you have to turn it over or whatever. It's an ordeal. I know.
So what happens when you're wearing a big hood over your head? That's when you're looking through the ground glass.
To get
the focus perfect, get the framing perfect. Then you take your that off. You already have the film loaded in here. And you stick that in and pull one of these out to expose the film. So pretty complicated. Wet plate process. Every element of it has to be done in the dark. So you have a piece of glass. You have to take the chemicals, including the silvering, and apply it. It has to dry to a certain extent, but not too much.
Oh, boy.
And then you have to put it in the film holder, take it outside, put it in the camera, expose it, and then immediately develop it.
Oh, my goodness.
So all of those, you know, everything... Before you put it
there's so many ways that it can go wrong. Oh, wow.
And then once you're done, you've got this.
Okay. And so this is more of a glass plate image.
Which it is also more delicate. It can break.
Yes, look at that. It is. So even if you're a super professional photographer, if you drop your box of negatives, they're all destroyed.
Oh, boy.
So, this is, again, made on a camera. Either of these could make that, but more likely it's something.
Okay.
So, those are really the types of images we're going to be looking at today.
Fantastic.
Or actually images made from these types
from
of images.
These types of, wow, that's interesting. So, so this podcast is going to be very, we're going to highlight a lot of things visually, but we, the three of us should also talk through what we're looking at so that people who are just listening can follow along with us too. But if you want to see what we're talking about, you can always go to the Extreme History Project YouTube page and click on and watch the YouTube version of this as well for those who are just listening to this as a podcast. So I wanted to
say that too. Thanks for that. Yes.
All right. So let's look at the next thing, Michael, and look at some of the photographs. Is that what we're going to look at
now?
That's
what we're looking at.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Wonderful.
So, we've been discussing a little bit about how historians utilize photographs and, you know, what we're always looking for when we're looking at material culture, that's objects as opposed to something that we read in the book. We're looking for the details that we can pull out of this. What does this tell us about? So this is the Jacob Van Grundy Saloon in Deer Lodge in about 1890.
Okay.
And there's a lot going on here.
There is.
You can see we got a dog up on the roof there.
I don't see the dog.
The dog is on the second story on the balcony.
Oh,
right
my
in the
gosh.
Middle.
Oh, I see him.
And you've got a saloon. You've got the saloon keeper. You can tell him by the big white apron.
Okay.
A lot of patrons out there. And you see a striped pole.
Yeah.
In front there. That means it's a barber shop.
Okay. So the barbershop right next to the saloon.
There's a barbershop right next to the saloon. Very typical during this period. You might have a barbershop in the actual saloon.
Oh, interesting.
So,
So
that's where we're starting here. And M.H. Rice, he is a photographer in Deer Lodge. Again, About 1890 or so.
Okay, so 1890 was that one.
Right.
And that was an outside photograph, but this one is an inside
this
that
is
we're
an
looking
inside
at.
Inside photograph.
Yeah.
And this is
interior of a saloon.
So bar stools weren't a thing back then, right? You stood up at the bar, you bellied up to the bar, and
that
you have a place to put your feet up that rail.
That is exactly right. And you do. That's where the term belly up to the bar comes from. You put your foot on that railing there.
Yeah, there's a railing right along the bottom of the bar itself.
And generally, you would see a bunch of spittoons on the floor here, and you can see there's one right behind that guy.
Oh, yeah, I see it. Yeah.
Very messy.
Very messy. A very messy floor.
Standing up, spitting on it.
But beautiful wooden bar.
Oh,
it looks
gorgeous.
Like it would have been, you know, brass or some sort of metal was where you'd rest your feet up on. And then a big, beautiful mirror and this cabinetry holding liquor or glasses and things like that, and a tin roof. It's really, you know, oh, and there's actual saloon doors.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Ashley just said that it looks similar to a Virginia City bar.
Yes.
And so,
true. So
they do all kind of have a very similar look. That's for sure. But I love, Nancy, the saloon doors that you see
swinging
in all the Westerns when they walk in
very
and
dramatic.
Swing the door
exactly.
open. Yeah. I love that. And that tin roof is beautiful. And you said, Michael, this one's from Bozeman, and I've tried to figure out exactly where this is and haven't been successful yet, but it is a beautiful tin roof and a beautiful bar.
There's other things going on here as well.
Okay.
Notice the mounted bobcat.
Oh,
right
there are
several heads here. You got a couple
of
heads. There's an antelope there.
Yes.
And a little bit about the bars. These are generally made out of pure mahogany.
Really?
That rail is in fact brass. That's mahogany. And all of this material, none of this is made it anywhere near Montana.
No, so where are they getting that?
This is coming from like Cincinnati. It's coming from New York. So all of this had to come on the train here.
Okay.
And you're right, Ashley. This does have the same kind of look as a bar might have in Virginia City in the 1870s. But this is a lot higher class than that. And if you can imagine, then they did have pretty elaborate bars like this as early as the 1870s in Virginia City. But can you imagine all of these pieces being transported via wagon?
No.
Those giant mirrors.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I can't imagine how they get the mirrors.
Right.
I mean, that's massive. Looks like two pieces and they're both huge.
Yeah. And generally a lot of the same companies who built these back bars built pool tables as well.
Oh, okay. And so what year do you think this is, Michael?
This is about 1915.
Okay, 1915.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the bar looks beautiful. The crowd looks a little rough, though.
Yeah, they do. I was just thinking
These are working guys.
I was just going to say kind of working class gentlemen.
And
here
it looks
at the
like
bar.
Broad daylight outside,
yeah.
too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Like they're drinking in the middle of the day.
They're day drinking. That's what they're doing.
They are day-drinking.
Definitely.
No shame in that.
And so that's compared to this. And this is the exchange in Helena.
Okay.
But you can see here, you can definitely see the spittoons.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But, you've got a lot of similarities. You've got the nice wallpaper. There's, I believe this is a tin roof as well. But, we know this one is from just about the same time as the other one. But this one, again, really pretty similar stuff. But it appears to be a nicer class.
It definitely does look like
these
a higher class.
Men
bar.
Are more well dressed and their hats look clean. They all have the same mustache.
They do.
Must have been in fashion.
It's big,
right
that big.
Then.
I don't know. Do you call that a handlebar mustache?
That's a handlebar for sure.
Yeah, there's a few. There's three, at least three handlebar mustaches that I see there.
Right.
So, and I love the big cash register behind the bar, right in the winter, in the near. That's
right.
And so there's
beautiful.
No tables anywhere in either of these
yeah.
photos. So they're not serving food or anything?
Generally, it depends on the place. If you go to the next slide.
Oh, look at that.
Totally
you will see
different.
A very
yeah.
different look here. And you can't even see the bar here, but this would be to
love that.
Over to the far left side. So this is against the side of the bar. That is away from the actual bar itself.
Okay.
And they did have tables
okay.
oftentimes. Those photos didn't really show that, but there are a lot of bars that are nothing but a bar, and that's it. There's no tables.
That's
there's
it. No, you just stood around with your drink, and then you get out of there when you're done.
Get out.
Okay. Or you lay down and sleep. These guys are playing. It looks like they're gambling on something.
They are playing Faro here. Faro. Interestingly, this is not even Montana. This is in Tombstone, Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And we have this in our collections?
This is in our collection. And there are a few things I drew in here that aren't really from our collection, just to compare.
Very, very few.
But for looking at the saloon culture,
This
is a really different view than those other ones.
Yeah.
You can look at who these guys are. You can see the guy right behind the table against the wall. That's the dealer. And Faro is a notoriously excellent game for the house and notoriously terrible.
Oh, interesting.
The Oriental is important too. This is the saloon that Wyatt Earp dealt cards in the same building. But you can see it's around 1900, so everybody's wearing derby hats except for the guy with the silk.
He's got a
lamp over his head. That's a gas lamp.
Looks like they all have newspapers too. Are those newspapers or are those?
Those are newspapers. Okay. And those would have, that newspaper would have been the Tombstone Epitaph.
Okay.
So, very different view.
Yeah, but I love that. They're all so interested in that game.
And look how there's jackets and hats hung up on the wall. I don't know if there were specific nails or if there were just some things sticking, but they're kind of haphazard. But then there's that one guy in the back, you can see he's got his hat on but not his jacket.
Yeah. Right.
I guess playing Faro you can get a little sweaty, maybe. I don't know.
But a lot of different, it looks like a kind of a mixed group of like working men with maybe, you know, some businessmen thrown in there as well. A little bit of a different mix there to me, looks like. But I love the lights above the game, so you can really see that this is a well-lit bar.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So I compare that to this. This is at Karst Camp in Gallatin Canyon, probably in the 1940s.
Okay, much
here
later.
You can see how bar style has changed, as well as the style of these well-fitted out dudes from the dude ranch.
This looks much more rustic.
Right. And it's all made to look that way. It's like the idea is to make it look like a bar that's actually even older than the ones that we have looked at from the 1900s.
Like a pioneer bar.
It's a pioneer.
But they're all sitting on stools now. And again, they look more rough hewn, like they were handmade or something. And I figure it's just fitting in with that whole style.
And there's women in this photograph.
And there's a lot of women in there.
Wait, and no women in any of the other photographs
in those
bars.
Because of things like the spittoons and the excesses of customers, which sometimes included vomiting and spilled beer and liquor, it was unheard of for women to go into a saloon at all until probably the 1920s.
Yeah.
So women, you just, as a woman, you didn't go in. If a woman did go in, everything would stop. Everything would just stop. Everyone would stare.
It's just too rough. Too rough.
By this time, those days are over. So but I think we're looking at these in a very historian type way. We're like looking at how are these different. So,
and instead of having a head mounted, look, they have a painting of an elk up there above. I'm sure they have some heads somewhere in there.
They must.
Look at the American tapestries.
They're all wearing hats. These cowboy hats, kind of.
These
are
big fancy dude hats.
Yeah,
cowboys generally aren't going to wear those.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the dudes are all wearing a hat.
And
do you think the gentleman on the right who has those
fancy chaps,
the chaps, is a dude, or do you think that's actually a cowboy?
It could be.
And I did
one.
Cowboy with air quotes.
It could be either one. If this is a cowboy, he's definitely working at a dude ranch.
Yeah.
For sure. Mm-hmm. A working cowboy is definitely.
No, because that doesn't. And they're sparkling clean. They look like they're white and they don't have like a piece of speck of dirt on them.
And look at the woman has some.
Chaps too. Yeah. So, when dudes came out to these dude ranches, they would buy all new clothes to go to these, so they hang out. They're living the dude life.
Okay.
So the lady bear in the foreground there, you can see she's got a pair of beaded gauntlets.
Oh, okay. So, is that what's on her lap?
Yep.
Okay.
They are all getting into.
Wow, that's a great photo. I love that, and that's Karst campus is not is in the
it's in Gallatin Valley.
Gallatin
and
Valley.
It is
right.
there. It does, it's not called Karst anymore, but the remnants of it are still there. If you go to the next slide, see it.
Okay.
Oh, wow. It started out as Karst Cold Stream Resort. This is about 1915, I would say. You can tell that by the acetylene lamps on the car.
Oh.
Karst started out as a stage station before automobiles or anything were here. And once it became more accessible by vehicles, they turned into a dude ranch as well. So it became a gas station. Really kind of that you can see the components of that still. That building that was the bar room, that is still up there. I don't think it's still a bar room.
And these all look like, you know, log cabins made to have that whole feel of coming out west to, you know,
That's right. So the next one is another shot of this. And this is, these are the Karsts. So this is them at the actual, the place. It's Pete and Jenny Karst. Again, this is probably around 1915 to 1920. But again, you could see it's meant to look super rustic.
Yeah,
they look super rustic.
They do,
but
they're working. They're working.
They're not
the
as
ranch.
Fancy
yeah.
though,
yeah.
right? As the people, I almost wondered if it was performers in the bar because they all look. But if you're saying they're guests that bought clothes, because these guys look like they're really doing the work out there. Yeah. They're not. There's nothing duty about them. You
That's
know?
Right. And if you again, you got to think about the date. This is probably 1920. Dude ranching in this area was just getting going.
Interesting.
So okay. these guys are more like. We run the stage stop.
Right.
But you know, and this is way out in the middle of nowhere at this point in time. I mean, it still is, really.
It really kind of is.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they were working out there, living out there. It was probably a pretty rough existence.
Indeed, it was. And they started out as homesteaders. If you go to the next slide, you'll see this is the Crail Ranch, which is now the center of Big Sky, Montana.
Okay.
So this is the Crail Homestead. This building is still there.
Oh, wow.
If you go there. And, this started out as a homestead. And they started out in about 1902. And eventually this was sold. This is the place that Chet Huntley bought in 1973 to start Big Sky.
And Big Sky is a big ski resort now,
huge
ski resort. And so
one of the biggest in the world or in the U.S.
It is.
Massive. Yeah.
And so it's this is kind of the beginnings of it here, I guess. And I love the kind of the things that are on the ground outside the cabin. They're the gentleman's boots or, you know, cowboy boots.
His mucky boots. With his hat on top. Yeah.
With his hat on top and some other things kind of strewn around. It looks like maybe a jug of something.
A can.
And,
for sure. And then the next one is their next door neighbors.
Oh, nice.
And this probably a little bit later. These are the Michener's.
Okay.
And
also in Big Sky.
Yeah,
then.
Also they're right next to Big Sky too. But they got their dogs out there.
Yeah,
and these look like the people in them built the houses themselves.
Yeah.
That's what kind of houses
yeah,
they're very modest
themselves.
And yeah, they're building their own structure. There's a this one at least has a little bit of a porch that's covered. The other one doesn't have that.
This looks more like a. You know, just a not as much of a log cabin look, but more of just a built wood frame house look. So it's a little bit different, but you can kind of see the log cabin look behind this one.
And it's not unlikely that that log cabin was built first,
and then
they
built
this frame building later.
Yeah. And all the kids are out there. So
in height order.
In height
except
order.
Except for the one
the
that's
little,
being held.
The little one.
And then two dogs.
So you can see there are generations of Michener's, and there are still Michener's who live in
Michener. Really?
Okay. Wow.
And the next one, continuing on our Gallatin Canyon look, this is up at the 9-quarter circle Dude Ranch. And this was, again, one that was established as a homestead that became a Dude Ranch. And so this is around, around 1920, right when Dude Ranch is getting started. So they've got a big herd of horses here.
The dudes would ride the horses. They would kind of go on horseback rides, just like they kind of do today at our ranch or at Chico or somewhere like that?
That is exactly right. Okay. And they, they would take them, or they could take them out on, organize hunting trips. Mm, you could go out overnight on a trail ride, something like that. Mm-hmm. Or you could go out on the trail ride and they would bring the chuck wagon out.
Okay. That sounds very similar to things you do at Dude Ranch today.
Yeah.
These were the innovators. Okay. So they're the ones we basically invented dude ranching in the area right around Yellowstone. And
really?
Yalta Canyon.
Wow. Is that true, Michael?
Wow.
That is absolutely true.
Know that. Wow. That's fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like how they get to be this old and live here this long and not know that.
The first dude ranch was the OTO Ranch, which is just really north of Gardner.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
So now we know who to blame.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, that's
where,
All right. So, yeah, I got another quick one of just their horse herd. But you can see it's gorgeous.
Oh, it's so pretty. And you know, if you make that drive today up the Gallatin Canyon, it looks just like this. It's still very much. This landscape is still very intact and it's beautiful up there. And you know, I can just see it as I'm looking at these photographs.
Horses look very
right. And this is a little bit further up the Gallatin Canyon than Big Sky, but these guys are all neighbors. And that's a thing that I don't think we kind of don't really understand that well now.
Right.
Just because they're all
doesn't
mean they're not a community. They all know each other. You know, they know what everybody's doing.
Mm-hmm. Depend on each other, I'm sure.
They absolutely depend on each other. You know what the winters are like.
Yeah, I can't even imagine living. That's why when I saw that for the Karst family and her dress, I'm like, oh, I feel for you.
I can't imagine
living up there through a winter. Right.
But Gallatin Canyon was also really popular just for people like from Bozeman to come up and come up for the day.
Much like
it is today. So
we still do that.
This bridge is sitting on top of House Rock.
Oh wow.
Oh my gosh.
So
and this is where people would be kayaking or taking rafting trips through today, right?
Yeah. Right. So it's the same idea. This is taken in 1905.
I wouldn't walk on that bridge.
They've been coming up here for a long time.
That's 1905, and that's the Gallatin River.
Wow. Right.
And House Rock is something that, you know, people just drive to see today. And the bridge is no longer there.
It's super dangerous because it's mostly covered, but the rafters all know it's there. Wow, that is crazy.
No, the bridge is gone. Long gone. And so, but there is a pull out on the highway, so you can pull out and you can stop and you can watch the kayakers and the rafters go by House Rock. And it's very, at certain times of the year, it's scary for those people because it's really moving. The river's really moving.
And if you don't know
where
it is, it could be an issue. Got some good rapids going.
That's really neat to see.
So Gallatin Canyon was always like kind of a recreational spot. Yeah. You go to the next one. See some campers out here going fishing. This is 1901.
Wow.
And this is at Hell Roaring Creek. And you know where there's a big bridge right there.
Okay.
We're still in the canyon here. So let's just talk for a minute about these outfits.
I was going to say they are all very well dressed. Very well dressed.
I mean, the women are, you know, dressed to a T. They have their Victorian jackets and skirts and those hats. They have some amazing hats that are just huge and beautiful, covered with flowers and different things, ribbons and bows and all sorts of things. I love that woman's cape on the left. And, you know, I can't imagine dressing like this to go fishing.
Right. Yeah, this is like a day trip. There's a photographer, Maurice Lammy.
Oh,
really?
So, Lammy family here.
Yeah.
The clothing that they're wearing, which people call costume. Even if you didn't know what the date of this was, you could definitely say, oh, this is like late 1890s, maybe 1905 or so.
Based on what they're wearing.
And you got to remember that just because it's 1901 doesn't mean they bought all their clothes that year.
Right.
So, that little girl's outfit in the front, I'd say that's more like mid-1890s.
Okay.
But this is a day trip. And the hats the men are wearing, Got a couple guys there wearing the Montana Pink, which is very similar to.
And they are in full three-piece suits.
Oh, yeah.
With bow ties.
I know. There's some bow ties. There's other formal ties.
For sure. Yeah, it's pretty.
Fitted jackets.
What we would consider to be pretty formal.
Look at the gentleman in the middle with the starched collar.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's what always amazes me about these camping or fishing photos from this time period is, and now what do you think, Michael? Do you think they went dressed like this knowing that a photographer was coming with them and they were preparing for that? Or do you think this is how they often went out to go fishing as a group?
This is how they often went out. Although, and I really like they brought their dog, but there are certainly more informal images as well.
Yeah, the dog in the middle. Yep.
There's another Gallatin Canyon trip. So a considerably
there
less
we go.
Formal.
Let's but you can still see
they're
bottles.
Wearing their collars and ties and everything.
They still have the starch collars, but they also have their bottles of whiskey or whatever it is, and their pipes and their. What do you think they're drinking, Michael?
I would say you've got at least one beer drinker, and you probably have at least one whiskey drinker.
Okay.
Now, I haven't compared this, but this is the same photographer in 1901.
So this is Maurice Lammy?
Yes.
In 1901. Wow.
So it's interesting. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something, Ashley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how long do they have to stand like this?
By 1901,
repeat
not very
the,
long.
Repeat the question.
So the question is, how long did they have to stand still for this image? And the answer is probably like maybe a second.
Okay.
By this period, you have much faster film. You're not using wet plate anymore. This is dry plate. And you've got a camera. It's got all these settings on it, so you can time this. It's practically like today. So not that long.
This is very much a boys' trip.
So before you move on, the last trip, the last picture especially, and this one with this formal dress, I think of Downton Abbey. I think of them going out on their property or to all do it. And they're the very upper classes. Yeah. And I feel like here we are out in Montana at the turn of the, century. And we're seeing these Americans who are not royalty or lords or anything like that. But are they emulating that idea of sort of being out in nature, all dressed up in this finery, which today seems so strange to us because that's not how we go out into the wilderness or nature or up the canyon, but it's interesting to think of what Americans were thinking about as they chose, that clothing and then to represent themselves that way in a photo,
Well, I would say no. These are generally middle-class guys.
Right? I know.
This is how you would walk around in downtown Bozeman. This is what they'd be wearing. And coming out to the wilderness is nothing new for these guys. They live in Bozeman. It's 1901. They're still, driving around. They're still riding around on their horses. I would say this is a not unusual day trip out of Bozeman. So.
People just dressed. They just
That's
dressed.
That's just how they did
Well, if you go back, Jim Bridger didn't dress like that. I mean, had your groups that come out that were rough. They were rough and they were the trailblazers and they were trading in furs that had some different classes of people. But that's what I mean. I mean, even when you look at this class, it looks like they're middle class, but they're sort of still emulating what you would imagine upper classes were doing in back in New York or in England. Yeah, it's interesting.
This is exactly
It just looks like a lot of effort for being middle class. I'm so happy not to have to do that anymore.
Okay, I got one last Gallatin Canyon one. So this is a different kind of camping where guy's going out hunting. So he's out there with his dogs. There's a good dog right in the foreground there. He's moving a little bit. And horses too. But this is a classic hunting trip. And of course, for Bozeman, even today, we have a lot of hunters. We had even more hunters. And Gallatin Canyon was a place where this type of activity was going on as well.
Yeah, and I love the tent. It looks like a tent he could just pull up really quickly. And probably moved around a lot as he was camping or as he was hunting and kind of camp as he goes. And he's not dressed quite as formally. So
definitely not.
More of definitely a hunting trip.
Absolutely.
But who took this photo? That's my question.
This is a photo by a guy named August Gottschalk.
Okay.
He was a commercial studio photographer in Bozeman. And this is considerably earlier. This is 1892.
Okay. So maybe this gentleman and they both went out and the photographer just thought, well, I'll take a couple of pictures as we're out here.
That's absolutely true. And we have a number of dot shots. I'm sure this is not the only photo of this trip. So, as I was mentioning before, you might have a photographer that took like 20 photographs of one trip into the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those has its unique elements to it. But if you want, as curator, if I'm looking for the thing that I want to put on display, you want the one that tells your story the best. Mm-hmm. So it's great for me because I can look at, oh, here's 20 pictures of this same series of events. This is the one that tells the story. But every one has details. And, the more you can zoom in on these, and, you can see there's a lot going on. He's got, he's a great, like, 1890 saddle on his horse. He's got, his pack saddles as well. Those are pack saddles.
Okay.
So, one of those would have gone on that horse, and there's obviously another horse that's not here as well. So,
right.
He's out hunting with his dog. So,
I think I see a bottle of liquor.
That's probably a whiskey bottle.
Yeah.
Right, so we're going to jump into a series on Bozeman.
Okay.
So these are some of the earliest images of Bozeman. Bozeman historians will be highly familiar with these.
Yeah.
But I thought this was good because, we're really familiar with them, and you can see a lot of details kind of about what's happening here. This is going to be about 1870, 1871, I believe. And this is a view on Main Street looking east.
Wow.
So, and occasionally we'll see photos in here that show buildings that are still standing, but there are other ways we can look at earlier maps of Bozeman or other types of documentation and say, well, this building was here, this building was here, this building was here. And this is a good way to kind of imagine what the look of this was. But you can see the street, it's all dirt, but very
mud.
Wide, which is the same.
Very wide.
Today.
Yeah.
These are some of the very earliest.
So, this is a stereo view. So can you talk about stereo views a little bit?
Absolutely. We've got a few stereo views here today. And the way this worked is you have a camera that's very much like the wet plate camera that I was showing you before. You pull that lens off and you put a camera plate on the front that has two lenses.
Okay.
That are basically.
So it'd be a different front then
different
to
front.
This one.
And each lens is about the same distance apart as your eyes are.
Oh, interesting. So that's
so
how
that
works. Yeah.
So that when you look at this image through a stereo viewer, it actually looks like it's in 3D.
Right.
Because it's exactly the same way as your eyes. So these images, though they look exactly the same, slightly different.
Right.
So, that's what stereo views are for. And that's why stereo views are great. You can look at that and it's like you're looking down the street in Bozeman.
It's really fun. Yeah.
So I love that you can see the photographer in the photo, the
that's
shadow
right.
of the photographer.
That's
I love
his,
that.
That is his shadow.
And then you can tell the time of year
because
there's a skiff of snow on the
right
on the street
snow,
and you can
still.
See the
and
snow.
And then even
the
that
mountains.
Long shadow, the time of day.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, this is a great photo. This is, and it's very rudimentary. Bozeman was founded in 1864. This is 1870. This is right at the beginning. So it's a great, great
1864
shot.
Is like they were putting up their first tents
in
town. Yeah. This is 6 years later. Is that right? Yes.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And go to the next one here. This is a pretty famous one too. And this is on the balcony of the Metropolitan Hotel. And this is looking west down Main Street.
So kind of the opposite direction.
Kind of the opposite direction. You see the Cooper block over there, the big
brick
structure there. And that remnants of that building are still there today.
Right.
Again, don't know this photographer, but we suspect that this photo is in 1872.
Okay.
A really important thing, too, is these wagon trains.
Yeah.
These are freight trains. So everything that comes to Bozeman has to come on those freight trains, and they are coming either from Salt Lake four from Fort Pitt.
So, a long way.
And that's why that street is so wide, is so that they could turn around on that street. And there's a barber pole in this photograph too, if you can see it. And that's the barbershop of one of our residents whose name was Samuel Lewis. And Samuel Lewis was an early resident of Bozeman, and he was born in the West Indies and made his way to Bozeman. And his claim to fame is his sister, Edmonia Lewis, was a famous, world famous sculptress. And she was known throughout the world, and he helped support her to a certain degree financially, because he was a very good businessman and he did well in Bozeman.
And she moved to live over in Europe, right?
Yeah. She lived in Rome, Paris, and died in London. So, but I love this photo because I love the guy standing there.
Yeah. That perspective is so great. Yeah, it's such a balcony. Cool. Yeah.
The way he's dressed is perfect for Bozeman in 1872. He's got the boots. He's got the big hat.
Yeah.
Sporting the beard as well. So, yeah, this is, it doesn't get much more Wild West than this. If we go to the next one, we got a different view of the Cooper building. This is 1874. And again, a lot of these dates, we might have, you know, three copies of it, and they're all different dates.
Yeah.
So, and you could say, well, maybe this photographer made it, maybe that photographer did. But you can see by the mounts that they're on, they're all this. Almost certainly the same photographer.
Yeah,
they're not marked or anything like that, but we're pretty darn sure that these were happening, you know, within a span of just a couple of years.
Were these donated to the museum?
These were donations, yeah. And you know, we might get, you know, one or two from one donor, and then one or two from the set from somebody else. So it's it can be a real hodgepodge. There's a lot of interesting things going on here too. On the left side of the building, you see there's a giant boot.
Can you zoom in?
Okay, sitting off the building.
Can you zoom in at all? Ashley, or is it hard to zoom in on this? That's okay. We can still see the boot, but the boot's cool.
And a couple of other things are happening here. I'm not sure if they have started here yet, but the Spieth & Krug Brewery is in this building.
Oh, I think it was down just a bit.
And it might be, yeah, it might be the one that's right next to it. But there was there were definitely saloons here. That's the one that has all the people standing in front of it. No question about that. but this building was really important to the city because it was a huge brick building. And again, you're only like 6 or 8 years after Bozeman was a tent city.
And, yeah, I was going to say, Ashley, we lost it.
It's only a few years after this was a tent city, and now you've got this huge thing. Bricks made in Bozeman. So, you know, you can see this is a growing concern.
Yeah.
People are serious about it. They know something is going to come of this.
Yeah.
So we have gone like through like a quarter of the slide. So I would recommend that we skip.
Yeah, we better. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, let's keep going. Do we want to skip that one?
We want to get to this one.
Okay. Oh, this is great. I love this.
So
love this.
Is the Leora Hafner House
in
1910.
Nice.
And the photo is by Leora Hafner. So I put in a few photos by Leora Hafner. Many people may recognize the name Hafner from Hafner Hall.
Yeah,
which is at Montana State University.
It's a
here.
Dormitory, and it was originally the women's dormitory specifically.
It still is.
And was the head of the education and psychology department between 1932 and 47.
And it looks like you can see the energy smokestack thing there, and then Old Main, the main thing on Montana's campus right there. Montana Hall is right there with the sort of steeple. And there's not much in between. So it's kind of a straight shot from her house visually.
And people who live in Bozeman might recognize this is taken at 700 South Church Street.
Oh, okay.
Today, if you go to this location, you can't see anything on the hill at all. They're like houses all.
Oh, that's so interesting.
But this is all farm fields here.
Okay.
So I wanted that. This was a good example of one photographer taking photos of a number of different subjects almost all at the same time.
And a woman photographer too,
which is rare.
And what time period again are we talking about?
This is 1910.
1910.
And she actually marked these photos herself, so we know what they are. So that's always a tip that historians want to give photographers. Label the photos.
Yes, so write the date on them.
But she did some great photography in some other kind of subjects. So if you go to the next one, she's got a whole series that are near immigrant. And
near immigrant Montana?
Immigrant Montana. This is in the Paradise Valley.
Okay.
About how far would this be from us? Like 40, 50 miles?
Yeah, like maybe 45, 50 miles from Bozeman.
But so she does, she's clearly spent a certain amount of time, probably just like in one trip, going over there to visit the Paradise Valley. And while she is there, she encounters this, which is a hay crew out there. You know, the Paradise Valley, big for ranching, and hay, of course, major part of that. So she took a few photos of it. This is clearly one family, and you've got this is a kind of a hay lift is what this is. And the family, here's the daughter and a couple of moms there while the men are out working the field.
Yeah.
Different view of this. This comes just kind of a bigger view. Oh, wow. Here's the whole crew. But there's might even be one more.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can see this is a big operation. But while she's over there in the Paradise Valley, she stops by the booming young town of Immigrants, which is next.
Oh yeah.
Very rustic. And the reason this town's there is because the railroad goes through on the way to Yellowstone. But while she's there, she does some pretty good documentation of different images. So this is on the main street in Immigrant. These are more like touring.
Yeah, I was going to say, but these are tourists going to Yellowstone.
It looks like they are tourists. Yeah. They could very well be exactly that.
Yeah.
And then the one behind it has all these bags of stuff. That might actually be
their luggage or something.
Yeah, they're going. Okay, sure. Maybe going into camp.
Yeah.
It looks like a Surrey with a fringe on top.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
I know.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think the next one is a duplicate. Go to the one after that.
Gosh, a little cottage hotel. She's a good photographer. All her images are beautiful.
Good. And yet, these are just snapshots.
Yeah,
as far as we know, this came out the same roll of film.
Wow.
And these were in actually the McGill collection.
Okay.
So it looks like she had one roll of film developed, and this is what was on. The first one was her house, and these other ones are her trip. And while she's in the Paradise Valley, of course, you have to go to Chico Hot Springs.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
That's an amazing view
that
of
looks
Chico.
A lot like it Chico, does. But a lot very, very much different than the Chico we know today, Chico Hot Springs. Wow. Look at it.
And she zoomed in a little bit to the next one.
Oh,
so this
look
shows
at that.
You this is what's going on. That is a white touring car there. And about 7 years after this photo was made, white touring cars would become the Yellowstone buses.
Okay. So those preceded the Yellowstone. To get people in. And you're not that far from Yellowstone.
No.
And you're at Chico. There's a ton of people on that porch that's in the shade. Look at that.
Yeah, everybody's kind of lounging
on the
porch
side.
And
yeah.
It makes sense if you're a tourist on your way to Yellowstone, you might stop off at this hot spring.
Yeah. So, I mean, those of us who have been to Chico, you can just see where that's at. That's right at the entryway there. We've been there many times. That's wonderful. That's the lodge, and then a lodge as well. And 1910, it was probably used as medicinal waters for people who would go there to for their health as well as for recreation.
Yeah,
that's neat.
Okay, so moving on from I know we've been talking a little bit about describing what we see here and some of the details. And another important thing that historians have to do when they are examining photos is look at what's not in the photos.
Sounds good.
A classic way to review this is by looking at images of American Indians.
Okay.
And we've got a number of really good photos in our collection. And this one is a chief of the Blackfeet tribe in about 1890, 1900. And this is Chief Little Dog and his daughter. Their outfits are terrific. Very typical Blackfeet. Although it's not in color, we can tell by the designs on them that this is very traditional Blackfeet.
Okay.
Generally, these colors would probably be black and red, probably with a little bit of blue on it. And his daughter behind him is wearing a blouse that's made of dentalia shells.
Yeah. Of course, look at all those.
Of beautiful. Course, if those don't grow, live anywhere around here. That's obviously comes from trade with a West Coast tribe.
Beautiful regalia. And then also, where are they sitting? Are they sitting in a lodge?
They are inside. They are in a lodge, also known as a teepee, which has it's got blankets on the floor, and that's what the background is here. It's the canvas from the teepee on the outside, and then they've got a teepee liner that is that thing.
Okay, that's beautiful. Yeah.
But what I want to point out here is the label on it. It says "Little Dog Chief of the Blackfeet." And this is by a photographer named N.A. Forsyth, who did a huge series of stereo views of American Indians, and he sold these commercially. So unlike a lot of studio photographers, say Bozeman, who would be selling photos just of people in town to give to their families or send to their friends, these studio photographers would go out into the field and make series of different photographic subjects, in this case, American Indians, for sale to, nationwide and worldwide. Mm-hmm. So these could be distributed. You might be looking at these in Germany.
Germany, I was just going to say.
For example,
sure.
Yeah, anywhere in Europe. Mm-hmm. And another example, this is the next one, outdoors. So this is at what's called the Choosing Dance. But you can see American flag here, very traditional, dance outfits and regalia. But what you don't see in any Forsyth images, you almost never see in any photos of American Indians, is how difficult and destitute these people were on these reservations. This is about, we're seeing around 1890s or so. They're, for the past 30 years or so, Native people have been literally starving to death on these reservations. They are legally banned from leaving the reservation without the permission of the government agent for that reservation. Times are extremely difficult here. And you never see images of that because these are being made for a particular purpose,
right,
which is to show the outside world this alien world of Native people who are live in the American West. And you can see that in a lot of the ways that Native people are represented in portraiture. So the next one we're showing, this is a photo of John Grass, who was a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. And during 1876, during the period of the Little Bighorn, he did not join with the other Unpapas who went and participated in the Little Bighorn battle. He stayed behind.
Oh.
And because of that, when the Unpapas were put on their reservation in Standing Rock, Dakota territory, they already had a very close relationship with the white people, particularly the agent there. And he was nominated as a judge for that Indian law on the reservation. This photo is says it's by Scott in Lander, Wyoming. But as a historian of this, I know that prior to coming to Lander, Scott was headquartered in North Dakota.
Okay.
In the Dakotas, very close to Standing Rock. And so this was one of the photographers, there are a few of them, who were basically itinerant photographers. Mm-hmm. They went from military port to military port in particular looking for Native people to take photographs of that they could sell. And there are a couple of different photographers who did exactly that. D.F. Berry, I got a couple of his photos here. But Orlando Scott Goff is a guy who worked out of Bismarck and later came through a series of Montana forts. He was at Crow Agency, went up to Fort Assiniboine, and ended up settling in Havre, where he became a representative, a Montana representative. He took with him, however, all of his glass plate negatives. So he might be in his studio in Havre and be selling photos of Sitting Bull and rain in the face. And people who he had taken photos of back in, you know, 1878 at his studio in Bismarck. But this guy, we know he was one of those people. So his mark says Lander, Wyoming, and you might think, oh, this is in his studio in Lander. No,
okay, interesting.
So next one is a different example. You can see here you've got a the last photo, you can see that guy was wearing completely Western clothes. They're trying to make him look very dignified.
He had his braids, but he had this very dignified jacket and the collar. He looked like somebody who could be a judge or some official.
Exactly.
In some sort, yeah.
And this is a this is a photo where a graph of a really important guy here in Montana. This is Plenty Coup, extremely important leader of the Crow Nation. And his house is now a state historic site. His cabin is still there. This is about 1910, but you can see this is a very different approach to the photography. He's wearing his complete, formal Native regalia here, but still showing this great gravitas. He is a great, important leader, and that is really what they're trying to demonstrate here.
Yeah, that's a great photo.
This is kind of towards,
you know, when he's older, there's a lot of photos of Plenty Coup out there, and I love this one. I love this photo a lot. It's a great one.
It's really a good one. You can tell again if you understand Crow dress. This is a very quintessentially Crow shirt. You've got Crow designs on the shoulders, the ermine furs in the front. So again, it's a thing where historians can look at this and say, yes, this is very Crow.
If they didn't know it was Plenty Coup, they could say, by the dress, I know this is Crow or Obsolaga.
Absolutely.
Right?
And
or
by
the hairstyle, too, I was going to say, is very distinctive.
Very Crow. It's Crow are really the only people out here. But if you go to the next portrait, this is a completely different way of seeing it. This is where he's trying, where this photographer, L.A. Huffman, out of Fort Kehoe, is really trying to show how different these people are than white people. And this guy is, what's his name? This is a guy named Scorch Lightning. And he is actually a Sansark Lakota who was clearly just in Fort Kehoe. Usually what happened is these types of photographers would pay Native people to come and sit for them. And then this is a photo that he would be selling in his studio. So the reason that this guy looks the way that he looks, the way he's posed, the way that he's posed, is because this is what appeals to the the people who are coming in and want to buy photos of, oh, this is the Old West. This is what I would see if I was in the Old West. You can see upside down there, Huffman is advertising himself as Yellowstone scenery and Indian views.
Wow.
This is his
as if they're just part of the scenery.
Yeah.
It looks a lot though posed and aesthetically like an Edward Curtis photograph, which, you know, so famous, him going out with those big glass plates and trying to document all these tribes, all these Native people, and he would take them and their hair would be beautifully arranged like this. They'd be wearing something beautiful. The lighting would be just so, and a lot is like this. And so it has that aesthetic appeal where I'm sure there was a market for that for sure. And this photographer looks very similar in his choices.
Yeah. It is. And this photo is probably the mid to late 1870s. And Curtis is working probably 20 years after that.
I see. Yeah. So this is before that. I had it backwards.
I didn't know
when it was from. Okay.
No, Curtis is working later than that. But this type of photography, he's really playing up this same aspect.
Absolutely. Aesthetic. Yeah.
Yeah, it's called pictorialism. And this guy is doing photography before pictorialism was even a concept.
Yeah.
He's already using it here through the lighting and his posture and kind of the solemn.
Well, and where he's having him gaze, the countenance of his face, just all of that, you know, but still bare skin showing. And it's very interesting. Yeah.
It is. Now, look at this one compared to the next one. We've got the bare skin
different.
Again, but looking very warlike.
Yes, and looking right at the camera.
Directly at the camera.
Fiercer look on the face, holding a weapon.
Right, and this guy is actually probably an uncle of the guy that we saw before.
Interesting.
Same photographer, different photographer?
Different photographer, probably made about the same time.
Okay.
But that is a Lakota war club, very serious. So, yeah, you can see how the photographer is trying to appeal to different audiences by posing them in different ways.
Yeah.
When you're the photographer in your studio, you run the universe.
Yeah, it's your world.
Yeah, these studio photos.
But they're not all, you know, trying to be extremely formal. In some instances, they're meant to be much more kind of documentary about who this person is. So if you look at the next one. Here's a Native guy, Crow Indian Hunter. Again, the same, this is L.A. Huffman again. Now, this is clearly in the studio. That's a backdrop behind him. But this is probably this person's real clothing.
Okay.
He sold me a Sharps rifle, and he's dressed up very warmly, so it says Crow winter wear.
But he's, again, it's just this generic... You know, there's no name. It's not as if this is an individual.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's a type specimen.
He's a type specimen. And that is exactly what a lot of these photographers were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we get this. And it says on the back who the guy is.
Okay.
But it's not because L.A. Heppman wrote that. Or that was an important thing to him. This is exactly right. That's a type specimen. But again, look at his hair.
Very distinctive.
This guy is wearing the Crow pompadour. But it's not always like this. You know, they're not always a type specimen. If you go to the next one, this is Hamilton out of Bozeman and White Sulphur. This could be something where these people came in and paid for a photo
and wanted a portrait, right?
They wanted a portrait.
Yeah.
And that's a good point about Curtis. Is that although his images were very, very commercial in a way, the families who own copies of those photos now, in many cases, that's the only photo they have of that person. And they treasure those.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's a lot of controversy, obviously, about Curtis as well. And our next guy kind of tells us why. This is David F. Barry and a friend of his from the Standing Rock Agency. This is Rain in the Face, who's a very serious Papa warrior, a major part of the Little Bighorn Battle. And this is in Barry's studio in Bismarck. Barry was in Bismarck for a number of years. Bismarck is located just north of Standing Rock. So he had access to people like Sitting Bull, like Rain in the Face, a number of people who were major parts of the Little Bighorn Battle.
Well known, yeah.
Well known. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, one of the interesting things about Barry, is that his mentor and later his partner was a guy named Orlando Scott Goff, who I had mentioned before. The reason Goff really even got his start in Bismarck at the studio is he came to Bismarck in 1873, which is the same year as Fort Abraham Lincoln opened.
Okay.
And the first group of people there were Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer and the 7th Cavalry. So he was the photographer first actually at the fort and then in Bismarck. So all of the officers went there to have their photos taken. He had those glass plate negatives. And after Little Bighorn, everybody wanted photos of those people.
Oh, wow.
He had the only photos of a lot of those guys.
Oh, gosh.
So his photos appeared in New York newspapers, internationally.
So he has all these credits all over the place.
So Barry came right at the acme of when these Custer photos were really important. And Goff was like, well, now I need to get the photos of the Native people. And Goff is arguably the first person who had a photograph of sitting bull. Barry kept up that tradition and got the first photos of several other important Pueblo leaders like Gall. He has the first photo of Gall taken like days after his surrender in 1881. So Barry was very much involved in his trade as well. Barry, the way Barry described himself, is photographer of famous Indians. So the next photo shows us a good example of Barry's work. And this is war chief, again, of the Apapa tribe, Good Horse. And this is in Barry's studio in Bismarck. And I know this because I'm one of the top historians on D.F. Barry, but that fur piece that he's wearing around his neck and that headdress is wearing don't belong to him. They belong to D.F. Barry.
Okay.
So it's a prop.
He was kind of putting those on him to dress him up for these.
That is right. And that's probably not his shirt either. Mm.
What's with the stars and all the embellishment? I mean, you don't see stars like that so much in the more traditional clothing. This is a really interesting getup.
It is an interesting getup. You might have seen a Native person wearing that as part of their outfit, but not anywhere around here, probably.
Okay.
But this is what they wear. This is something that Curtis was famous for as well.
Right, having props.
And that is one of the knocks on Curtis. That's why a lot of current American Indians say Curtis was terrible. He came and posed these people and gave them props. Curtis carried around trunks full of different props, depending on what nation he was going to. Mm-hmm. That was part of this tradition. Mm-hmm. So for Curtis, it was like, he didn't even think twice about that. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody does. And this is a perfect example of Barry starting
that tradition.
Interesting.
Curtis was then just kind of following what a lot of these forerunners in photography had been doing.
Then. Exactly. Yeah, so when you were pointing out that Heffman image saying, oh, this looks like a Curtis, Curtis was continuing that tradition and also this tradition.
Okay. So how many more do we think we have?
We got a few more Native American ones.
Okay.
We'll call it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Sounds good.
And then we do have, go to the next one here. Beautiful photograph. But considerably later, we don't even know who this photographer was. We know this is Chief Eagle Feather and his Lakota son. Again, you've got the studio backdrop. But this actually has a painted teepee as part of the backdrop.
And it's been colorized, it looks like, too.
It's been colorized. Yeah. It's hand colored.
Okay.
So, I think, but not all images, obviously, are portraiture. And go to the next one. You can see these are a Crow agency about 1888. It's photographer's W.R. Cross. And again, it's posed, but it's definitely, it's outside.
It's in situ.
It's got the kids out. You got the wagon out. You actually have that brush arbor behind him there and the teepee encampment. This is exactly what you see at Crow Fair today. And obviously a lot of photography going on at Crow Fair. It's the exact same idea. And you can see this is, in fact, the clothing that those Crow cowboys would be wearing. They are dressed like cowboys. I got another one here. And this is from a completely different reservation, but same idea. This is a Shoshone family and kids in front of their teepee. This is about 1915.
So would they be selling these photographs as well? Absolutely. Or are these more just, okay, all right.
Yeah, they would be selling these. Okay. And this is probably a Lander, Wyoming photographer, but I know because I'm familiar with this reservation. This is on the Wind River Reservation in central Wyoming. And you can see by the dome top of that, this is one image Asteria.
And so would they have left or provided a copy for the family, or would they have just taken these images, maybe paid them something for it, and then left?
They would almost certainly have just paid them for them and left. In order to view this, you actually have to have a stereo viewer, and it's unlikely that Native people would have one of those. They could probably just buy one. And I'm sure if they did have one, he would give it one. But the other thing to remember is he's not developing these on
right
site.
There. So there's
he
no,
takes them back.
Right, yeah.
So there's, it's not even printed while he's here. Most likely he paid this family to do these photos. Mm-hmm. And then he went back to his studio and made a series of, there's 50 images of Native people on the reservation.
Right.
But again, great image. This family is not identified. But it's surprisingly often that American Indian people can come and look at this collection.
Someone
people
will recognize.
Identified and they recognize it. They'll say, I've got a copy of this.
Yeah.
This is my family.
Yeah.
And for a family to have an image like this, it's priceless. And it's the same thing for any family.
Right.
To find.
But
to
be able to have that.
It's so much more rare for these people who are desperately poor to have something like that of this extremely difficult period for Native people. Maybe one more. This is a hand-colored image. Again, crow, but beautifully hand-colored. And again, this is an image not even named. We don't know who the photographer is, but somebody went to the trouble of hand tinting this, clearly one for commercial sale.
It's a beautiful image.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
So that's a good one.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you're looking at a large collection like we have at the Museum of the Rockies, you go a little bit beyond this, figure out, what's on that horse or how many spittoons are here.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll run across something in a collection and it just jumps out at you as just being a spectacularly beautiful photo.
Oh, look at that.
Wow.
So this is an Egypt Rice photo around mid to late 1880s and at a deer lodge. But it's a spectacular photo. Really unusual.
That's
very unusual.
Yeah.
It is. It's kind of haunted.
It is a little bit.
So describe it for the listeners.
So this is a photo of a woman looking in a mirror at herself, and the photograph is taken from the back of her. So you see her hair and then you see her face. It's like, now we do these all the time, or younger people than me do these all the time, these kind of
like the selfies,
selfie photo.
In the mirror. I know, but here but she's looking directly into the camera through the mirror. So you see this beautiful gaze, but you're seeing the back of her very long, beautiful hair, the way it's styled in the front, her dress, and the way it's framed in the mirror is just beautiful.
Beautiful
light. It's lovely.
And we have a huge collection of this photographer's work, studio photographer. He's the only one even remotely similar to
this. I wonder what made him take this photo.
We will never know. And that's kind
wonderful.
Of one of the beauties about having a big collection like this. You'll be running through lots and lots and lots of photos, and you'll run across something like that that's like completely out of the
blue.
And that's a photo that's kind of, it's, I wouldn't say it's lost in our collection, but there's so many images.
Right, yeah.
But that, it's such a gem.
Yeah, that's a beautiful photo to end on. That's wonderful.
That's a great one to end on. If you have any other questions, I know we've probably gone a little bit long here. But
no, that was wonderful. That was great.
I think it just gave us such an amazing overview, really, of the gems that are in there, but also what you can do and what you can learn. It just makes it more inviting to kind of delve into that online page on the website where you can access the archive.
I think
that's fantastic.
So we encourage to go and look at the online website, the Museum of the Rockies website, their online photograph collection, and just look around, just browse around, and you'll see lots of other photos that we didn't look at today, but these photos were spectacular. Thank you.
Thanks so much,
Michael.
That was huge.
Pulling these
fantastic.
Together. That was great.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to work with you folks.
Yeah.
And come check us out at Museum of the Rockies online at museumoftherockies.org. And if you have any questions about photos or anything else here, you can always contact me directly right here at Museum of the Rockies. So thank you.
Thanks. And thanks, Michael, so much. And thanks to all our listeners out there and potentially our viewers. If you love this podcast, please tell a friend and please like it, subscribe so it shows up in your feed whenever we have a new one, which is usually every other week.
And
leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So thanks so much for being with us today. We hope you can join us again to find out more about the dirt on the past.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks so much, guys. And if you are watching this on YouTube, if you could just press the like button on that too, or the thumbs up button, that would be wonderful. So a big thank you again to the Museum of the Rockies for the use of this beautiful studio space. Thank you to Ashley
had a lot of work today. Thank you, Ashley. Yeah.
And thank you to Michael Fox and Melissa Dawn and Chelsea Hogan for all their work in helping us bring this great information and this beautiful photograph collection to you today. So thanks, everyone.